Greetings and femto regalian stripulations, my ludicrously unmeretricious listeners, and welcome to this April 2018 Science News Update. I'm your host for this lushly enchanting science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Well, I haven't found any idiot scientists of the month again this month, but several of you listeners have asked me the same question in the last couple of months, which is related to idiot scientists, and the question is why? Why do these men and women go the sloppy route? What is leading to all these papers with bad science, even sometimes from scholars with the best of intentions? Well, I have a couple of answers. I suspect some of those factors may be true for anybody's career and not just for scientists. First, well, as academics, there's a constant pressure from the top to publish and get grants for those who do not have tenure or have not yet been fully promoted. Worse, if you're a postdoc and want a real tenure-track job at all, research funds are getting tighter than ever and good positions are getting hard to come by. To get grants and jobs, scientists need to publish, preferably in big-name journals. That pressure may lead researchers to publish many low-quality studies instead of aiming for a smaller number of well-done studies. To convince administrators and grant reviewers of the worthiness of their work, scientists have to be cheerleaders for their own research. They may not be as critical of their own results as they would be, or should be, of somebody else's. And even with the best of us, that is very hard sometimes. Second, getting published just isn't enough anymore, strange as that may sound. When I talk with my provost, he's certainly interested that I published a bunch of papers, but he wants to know where those papers were published as well. He will actually look up the quality of the various journals. You see, for scientists, publishing in a top journal like Nature or Science or Cell, with high citation rates or impact factors as they're called, it's kind of like winning a medal. Universities and funding agencies award jobs and money disproportionately to researchers who publish in those journals. And many researchers say that the science in those journals isn't really much better than studies published anywhere else. It's just splashier and tends not to reflect the messy reality of the real world. Mania, like my provost's, linked up to publishing in high-impact journals, may encourage researchers to do just about anything to publish there, sacrificing the quality of their science as a result, and potentially even making stuff up. Third, well, crappy papers can come from experiments that get contaminated. It's possible that cells and animals that others have used or purchased may not be as advertised in the actual journals. In hundreds of instances since the 1960s, researchers misidentified cells they were working with. It happens. Heck, a report from about a year ago suggested that bacterial DNA in lab reagents can interfere with those microbiome studies that I always keep telling you about. Fourth, remember that most biologists are not mathematicians, especially the MDs, who did not exactly take a lot of statistical courses. They may make math errors by mistake. Worse, some purposely play with stats by massaging data to achieve particular statistical criteria. Small sample sizes, improper blind studies can lead to statistical errors. Data-heavy studies require multiple convoluted steps to analyze, with lots of opportunity for errors or just introducing slight changes in your favor. Researchers can often find patterns and mounds of data that have absolutely no scientific meaning, but they give them meaning anyway. Sometimes bad papers come about because the scientists simply left out data or purposely used the wrong reagents or antibodies or animals. They do this on purpose so nobody else can replicate their data. Certainly, you don't want competition, after all. Another reason why the data in papers is wrong sometimes and not reproducible can come down directly to the science itself. Biology is messy. All those variables can be hard to reproduce. If you're a really sucky scientist and don't care, then you may not even report every factor correctly or completely, or even realize that they were there. Sometimes we don't even see data that has been rechecked or experiments that have been reperformed because journals want new findings. They don't want to see the same analyses repeated again. That gives researchers not much incentive to check previously published work or to try to publish those findings if they do. False findings go unchallenged, and negative results, ones that show no evidence to support the scientist's hypothesis, those are rarely published. Some people fear that scientists may leave out important, correct results that don't fit a given hypothesis and publish only experiments that do. So all these reasons lead to lousy papers and stuff we cannot always trust in journals, and even the good ones sometimes. I don't think that the scientists involved ever set out to be idiots, but very often it just comes out that way. Okay, first actual story of the night. Let's go up into space for this one. As you probably already know, there's a massive black hole at the center of the Milky Way. Well, it turns out that alpha black hole is not quite by itself. Dr. Charles Haley of Columbia University and his colleagues reported in the journal Nature April 4th that there are additional black holes slowly spiraling inward toward the center of the galaxy. The center of the Milky Way may actually be abuzz with black holes, if you want to put it that way. For the first time, a dozen small black holes have been spotted within the inner region of the galaxy in an area spanning just a few light years. And there could be thousands more. Isolated black holes don't emit any light, but black holes stealing material from orbiting stars will heat that material until it emits X-rays. In 12 years of X-ray telescopic work, Haley and his colleagues have found 12 objects emitting the right X-ray energy to be black holes with stellar companions. Based on theoretical predictions of how many black holes are paired with stars, that could be up to 20,000 invisible solo black holes just in that small part of the galaxy. The discovery follows decades of astronomers searching for small black holes at the galactic center, where that supermassive black hole lives. Theory predicted that the galaxy should contain millions or even 100 million black holes as well overall, with a glut of black holes piled up near the center. But none had been found, well, up until now. Haley says, quote, "It was always kind of a mystery. If there's so many that are supposed to be jammed into that central parsec of about 3.26 light years, why haven't we seen any evidence?" Unquote. It's unclear how the black holes got to the galaxy center. Haley suggests gravity could have tugged them toward that supermassive alpha black hole that's present there. Or, alternatively, he suggests that black holes could be born in a disk around that supermassive alpha black hole. Haley, to assure us that his group did not make a mistake, ruled out other objects emitting X-rays, like neutron stars and white dwarfs, but he acknowledged that up to half of the sources they found could be, quote-unquote, fast-spinning stellar corpses called millisecond pulsars rather than black holes. Okay, for the next story, let's stay in space. Well, sort of in space. So on March 15th, NASA released its preliminary findings on its astronaut twin study. This was reported by Monica Edwards and Lori Abadi of NASA Human Research Strategic Communications. So you may remember the story. One of the twins stayed on Earth while the other stayed at the International Space Station for months. And the question was, have they physically or genetically diverged from each other? Well, it turns out that Mark and Scott Kelly are still identical twins. Scott's DNA spent months in space along with him, and it didn't fundamentally change. What researchers did observe are changes in gene expression, which is how your body reacts to your environment. This is likely within the range of humans under stress on Earth, like mountain climbers or scuba divers. The change related to only 7% of the gene expression that altered during spaceflight that had not returned to pre-flight after 6 months on Earth. This change of gene expression seemed to be very minimal, We are now at the beginning of our understanding of how spaceflight affects the molecular level of the human body. NASA and the other researchers collaborating on these studies expect to announce more comprehensive results on the twin studies this summer. NASA described the research as a, quote, perfect nature versus nurture study, unquote, one that could provide important insights into the effects of long-term spaceflight on the human body. By measuring the large numbers of the brothers' metabolites and cytokines and proteins, the researchers are able to learn that spaceflight is associated with oxygen deprivation stress, increased inflammation, and dramatic nutrient shifts that do affect gene expression. Although most of the biological changes Kelly experienced in space disappeared in hours or even days after his return to Earth, NASA said some of those alterations appeared to have persisted and have still persisted. While 93% of his genetic expression has returned to quote-unquote normal, whatever normal is, several hundred space genes, as they are being called now, have changed activity level, the data suggests. NASA said this could indicate longer-term changes in genetic expression caused by the stresses of spaceflight, and they may even be permanent. Increasing mission duration from the typical 6 months on the International Space Station to 1 year resulted in no significant decreases in Scott's cognitive performance while in flight, and relative to his twin brother Mark on the ground. However, a more pronounced decrease in speed and accuracy was reported post-flight, possibly due to re-exposure and adjustment to Earth's gravity, and of course the busy schedule that enveloped Scott after his mission with hundreds of scientists looking at him. All right. Next story. Splenda sucks. Okay. So I'm being kind of harsh because Splenda has made me sick for years if I accidentally ingest it. I was really annoyed as hell when the idiots at Pepsi decided that Diet Pepsi should have Splenda instead of NutraSweet. And the problem is, when I walk into a restaurant and ask for a Diet Coke, and the waiter or waitress decides not to tell me that they only have Diet Pepsi, and I get mysterious stomach cramps a couple of hours later. Yes, I did literally mean sucralose makes me physically ill. By the way, I think that Pepsi has finally decided to change back. 200 people have complained about the alteration in their formula. Anyway, so what news is there about sucralose, nay Splenda? Well, apparently I'm not the only one who gets sick from that toxic crap. According to Dr. Alex Rodriguez Palacios of the Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine, my doctoral alma mater, by the way, he reported in the journal Inflammatory Bowel Disease that the artificial sweetener sucralose, Splenda, worsened gut inflammation in mice with a Crohn's-like disease. Rodrigo Palacios says, quote, "Our findings suggest that patients with Crohn's disease should think carefully about consuming Splenda or similar products containing sucralose and maltodextrin. Several studies have examined the ingredients found in this widely available product separately. Here we use Splenda as a means to test the combined effect of the commercial ingredients and used one of the best animal models of ileal Crohn's disease," unquote. Half of the mice studied belonged to a genetic line that suffers a form of Crohn's disease and were more affected than the remaining half of the mice, which belonged to a healthy mouse line. Splenda produced an intestinal overgrowth of E. coli and increased bacterial penetration into the gut wall, but only in Crohn's disease-like mice. Moreover, the research team also found the Splenda ingestion resulted in increased myeloperoxidase activity in the intestines of mice with bowel disease, but not in healthy mice. Myeloperoxidase is an enzyme in the white blood cells that is effective in killing various microorganisms. The point is kind of that the increased presence of E. coli intensified the levels of this enzyme activity in the bowel as the body sought to fight off the invader. The findings suggest that the consumption of Splenda may increase myeloperoxidase production only in people with a pro-inflammatory disposition, like Crohn's disease or some other forms of inflammatory bowel disease. As part of this process, inflammation and its attendant consequences could exacerbate the symptoms of Crohn's disease. Obviously, somebody with Crohn's would want to know this. Rodriguez Palacios finished by saying, quote, "This study demonstrates that the sweetener induces changes in gut bacteria and gut wall immune cell reactivity, which could result in inflammation or disease flare-ups in susceptible people," unquote. I wonder how many people besides me who do not have Crohn's disease are sickened by Splenda. Just curious. I will never be a big supporter of that stuff. Next story. Scientists at the University of Basel in Switzerland have created artificial organelles that can function as tiny intracellular implants in living organisms. If you're unfamiliar with the term organelle, it simply refers to a subcellular structure, usually with a membrane around it, that does a particular job inside of a cell. It's the equivalent of an organ in an entire animal, like a heart or something like that. But in the case of a cell, it's doing much more particular jobs, like making energy or breaking down wastes or nutrient products or recycling things. There's lots of organelles, but this is the first time anybody has produced them artificially. So when tested in zebrafish embryos, these membrane-bound artificial organelles were carrying an enzyme called horseradish peroxidase, and they were taken up readily by the cells in embryos, and the encapsulated enzymes were activated in response to a whole series of intracellular chemical changes. Dr. Cornelia Pavlin's team claims that their achievement could pave the way for the development of new forms of personalized therapy. The paper came out last month in the journal Nature Communications and is entitled, quote, "Biomimetic Artificial Organelles with In Vitro and In Vivo Activity Triggered by Reduction in Microenvironment," unquote. Pavlin says, quote, "We've now been able to integrate these controllable artificial organelles into the cells of a living organism for the first time," unquote. Artificial organelles are composed of nanospheres that compartmentalize active compounds like enzymes and proteins or catalysts, and they can function in the intracellular environment. They could feasibly be used to change cellular conditions and reactions, or to detoxify harmful compounds, or to provide signals for other cellular functions. Natural organelles have membranes, as I mentioned earlier, to retain compartmentalization, to keep them separate from the rest of the cell, and to confine enzymatic reaction spaces. That compartmentalization has to be a key feature of artificial organelles, the authors point out. Another essential factor for fine-tuning artificial organelle functionality is the triggered response to environmental cues, like, again, changes in the chemical state of the cell, like pH and things like that. Nanoscopic chemicals called polymerosomes represent the ideal candidates for creating these artificial organelles, a paper says. These self-organizing hollow spheres have a membrane that can act as a boundary layer for an inner cavity and also give the spheres greater mechanical stability than exhibited by artificial organelles that are based on other structures like liposomes, which are basically what actual organelles are made out of, membranes. To generate prototype controllable artificial organelles, the team constructed these polymerosomes and encapsulated that horseradish peroxidase enzyme I mentioned earlier. And it's only activated when specific molecules penetrate through the outer membrane. The horseradish peroxidase was chosen as a model enzyme because peroxidases play a serious role in the control of things like pH, homeostasis in cells. Control of enzyme activity was achieved by incorporating into the polymerosome membrane genetically modified pore, enzymes, channels that act as responsive gates to changes in pH. Pavlan says our artificial organelles preserve their architecture and were activated after reaching the cellular microenvironment. More exciting, they are functional in a vertebrate zebrafish model, and that proves that the concept of artificial organelles as cellular implants is feasible in vivo. Unquote. Next story. Morning sickness. For you pregnant ladies out there, this may come as a comfort or an annoyance, but scientists have finally figured out what causes extreme morning sickness in some women, but not in others. I guess that morning sickness is not an uncommon condition with pregnancy of most women. However, in a small percentage of women, about 2% according to the paper, there is an extreme form of morning sickness called hyperemesis gravidarum, HG for short. HG can be so bad that it can put both the mother and the fetus at grave risk. And now in a new study led by investigators at UCLA, they've identified two genes associated with HG, whose cause has not been determined in previous studies. Findings from the new study, published earlier this month in Nature Communications, in an article entitled, quote, Placenta and Appetite Genes, GDF15 and IGFBP7, are associated with hyperemesis gravidarum, unquote. Quite a title there. The two genes identified are both involved in the development of the placenta and play important roles in early pregnancy and appetite regulation. Head of the study, Dr. Marlena Fejzo of the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA says, quote, it has long been assumed that the pregnancy hormones, human chorionic gonadotropin, or estrogen, were the likely culprits of extreme nausea and vomiting. But our study found no evidence to support that at all. The two genes we identified, coincidentally, are likely to cause cachexia, which is weight loss and muscle wasting that leads to death in about 20% of cancer patients and has similar symptoms in HG, unquote. Current medications to treat the condition are largely ineffective and can lead to serious health consequences for both the mother and the baby. The condition is the second leading cause of hospitalization during pregnancy. Women often require intravenous fluids and, in the most severe cases, feeding tubes. Previous research has shown that severe nausea and vomiting during pregnancy often runs in families, suggesting that genetics does play a role. For the study, the team compared the variation in DNA from pregnant women with no nausea and vomiting to those with HG to see what the differences were between the two groups. DNA variation around the genes GDF15 and IGFBP7 were associated with HG. The findings were then confirmed in an independent study of women who had HG. In a separate follow-up study, Fejzo then showed evidence that the proteins from the two genes are abnormally high in women with HG. The next step is to determine whether GDF15 and IGFBP7 protein levels can be altered safely in pregnancy to minimize nausea and vomiting. These findings suggest a new avenue of research into a condition for which treatments have progressed very little in the last 70 years. Fejzo concludes with, quote, it is my hope that one day a medication that affects this pathway will be used successfully to treat and possibly cure HG, unquote. Here's another health story that concerns salt in our gut biome. Yes, it's another bacteria in our digestive tract story. Wahoo, I know. But let's just get to it. A study published this month in Nature shows that a diet high in salt can actually alter the gut biomes of mice by depleting it of good bacteria, specifically a bacteria called Lactobacillus murinus. The study also shows that treating mice with L. murinus helps to reduce symptoms of autoimmune conditions by altering the immune response. Team leader Nicola Wilk of the Max Delbruck Center for Molecular Medicine says, quote, our lab has previously studied the effect of high salt environment on T cells of the immune system. However, we have never studied the effect of salt on the microbiome in relation to the immune system, unquote. Wilk-fed mice with a high salt or a normal salt diet and then studied their gut microbial communities. Mice that consumed a high salt diet had low amounts of certain bacterial species, including L. murinus, compared to mice eating a normal diet. In culture, salt also inhibited the lactobacillus growth. Mice fed a high salt diet also showed an increase in the number of Th17 cells in the blood. Those cells play a role in hypertension. The number of Th17 cells decreased when the mice consumed lactobacillus. The team wondered if lactobacillus might help treat salt-induced hypertension. So they treated mice on a high salt diet that had developed high blood pressure with L. murinus. Blood pressure declined during the course of that treatment as a result of decreased production of those Th17 cells. To analyze the role of salt on the human gut microbiome, Wilk did a pilot study on humans. She recruited healthy volunteers who agreed to consume high salt diet and salt tablets for 14 days. As expected, this caused an increase in blood pressure, an increase in the Th17 cells, and an accompanied loss of certain lactobacillus species in the volunteers. Wilk finishes with, quote, "We want to extend the human studies further. We would like to study the immune effects of high salt on a large cohort to see if probiotic treatment can protect against hypertension and immune disorders," unquote. Cool. Eat more salt, get high blood pressure. Eat yogurt to fix the problem. Sure, I'm sure it's not as simple as that. As usual, it'll be much more complicated. Okay. The last story of the night concerns the mantis shrimp. I know, not exactly exciting, but just listen. These little buggers are more interesting than you'd think. Dr. Lessa K. Grunenfeld from the University of California, Riverside, headed up the study, which looked at what makes these little guys so incredibly tough. Her work was published in the journal Advanced Materials last month and is entitled, quote, "Ecologically Driven Ultrastructural and Hydrodynamic Designs in Stomatopod Cuticles," unquote. Okay, so the title isn't that exciting. But let me tell you, as ambush predators, mantis shrimp excel at lying in wait for their prey before striking from the shadows with specialized feeding appendages. But the form and function of those appendages has divided the mantis shrimp species into two evolutionarily distinct groups. First, there are the spearers, and the spearers use sharp harpoon-like appendages to slash and stab at their soft-bodied prey. And then there are the smashers, and the smashers use blunt, hammer-like appendages to break into hard-shelled crustaceans. These bulbous, smashing appendages, known as dactyl clubs, are capable of accelerating at 100,000 meters per second. That, by the way, is similar to a small-caliber gun bullet. And they can apply crippling forces equal to about 2,500 times the actual body weight of the mantis shrimp. Wielding such powerful weapons makes the mantis shrimp a formidable predator. But how can they apply those devastating blows and remain undamaged after constant use? Grunenfeld built on previous work investigating the structural regions of those feeding appendages, and focused on examining the structure and evolutionary history of the previously unexamined area called the striated region. Using both optical and electron microscopy, the team carefully examined and compared cross-sections taken from the appendages of the smashing peacock mantis shrimp and the spearing zebra mantis shrimp in order to learn more about the role of the region. They found that the striated region of the smasher is composed largely of tightly packed sheets of mineralized chitin compared with the organic components of the surrounding regions. They also found that this region of toughened chitin wraps all around the club, leading the authors to compare its role with that of the hand wrap used on boxers, condensing the fist into a tight ball and preventing catastrophic injury upon impact. This region was also found to contain a network of pore channels that allow for ion transport and give the region its striated appearance. As far as the spearers were concerned, they found that the tightly packed mineralized chitin was all along the length of the spear, so that it was designed to aid in impact as it pushed into prey. With the aim of applying this knowledge to humanity's benefit, Grunenfelder describes how the microstructures of these weaponized feeding appendages could be used to influence the biomimetic design of new materials. She highlights her particular interest in aerospace and sports industries with the goal of creating more durable aerofoils for aircraft, as well as bicycle helmets and golf clubs that maximize speed and strength without sacrificing structural safety. I guess in these turbulent times, it's refreshing to see that scientists are hoping to turn one of nature's deadliest, most durable swords into plowshares. That's all for me for now. As always, take care. Don't use Splenda if you have any signs of bowel disease. Watch that salt intake. Keep away from mantis shrimp. They're dangerous. Keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.